Smelling bad, but I didn't think much of it. I remember the guy across the street was complaining, but it wasn't like either one of us really thought it was human. Possum or something. Could have been a dog or a deer. There's a surprising amount of wildlife around here.
Did you see the body?
No, ma'am, not me. I got as far as the porch and turned around and came back. I didn't even knock. Man, I knew something was wrong, and I didn't want to be the one to find out what it was. I called 911, and they sent a cop car. Even the officer had a hard time, had to hold a handkerchief across his mouth.
J.D. crossed to the pantry, where he took out a couple of cans of tomato sauce. He took the crank-style can opener from a nearby drawer and began to remove the lid on the first can.
"You think she was murdered?" "She was too young to die without some kind of help," he said.
He dumped the contents of the first can into the skillet and then cranked open the second. The warm, garlicky smell of tomato sauce wafted up from the pan, and I was already thinking maybe meat wasn't so bad. Other people's cooking always makes me faint with hunger. Must be the equivalent of lost mothering.
"Any theories?"
"Not a one."
I turned to Lita.
"What about you?"
"I didn't know her that well. We put the vegetable garden back in that corner of the property, so I'd sometimes see her when I went back there to pick beans."
"No friends in common?"
"Not really.
J.D. knew Lorna's supervisor out at the water treatment plant. That's how she heard we had a cabin in the first place. Other than that, we didn't socialize. J.D. doesn't like to get too chummy with the tenants."
"Yeah, first thing you know, they're giving you excuses instead of the rent check," he said.
"What about Lorna? Did she pay on time?"
"She was good about that, at least until the last one. Otherwise, I wouldn't have let it ride," he said. "I kept thinking she'd bring it by."
"Did you ever meet any friends of hers?"
"Not that I remember."
He turned to look at Lita, who shook her head in the negative.
"Anything else you can think of that might help?"
I got murmured denials from both.
I took out a business card and jotted my home phone on the back.
"If anything occurs to you, would you give me a buzz?
You can call either number. I have machines on both. I'll take a look at the cabin and get back to you if there's a question."
"Watch the bugs," he said. "There's some biggies out there."
Chapter 6. I nosed the VW down the narrow dirt road that cut into the property close to the rear lot line. The lane had once been blacktopped, but now the surface was cracked and graying, overgrown with crabgrass. My headlights swept along the two rows of live oaks that defined the rutted pathway. The branches, interlocking overhead, formed a tunnel of darkness through which I passed. Shrubbery that once might have been neatly trimmed and shaped now spilled in a tumble that made progress slow. Granted, my car may have seen better days, but I was reluctant to let branches snap against the pale blue paint. The potholes were already acting on my shock absorbers like a factory test. I reached a clearing where a crude cabin loomed in the shadows. I did a three-point turn, positioning the car so I could avoid backing out. I doused the lights. The illusion of privacy was immediate and profound. I could hear crickets in the underbrush. Otherwise, there was silence. It was hard to believe there were other houses nearby, flanked by city streets. The dim illumination from streetlights didn't penetrate this far, and the sound of traffic was reduced to the mild hush of a distant tide. The area felt like a wilderness, yet my office downtown couldn't have been more than 10 minutes away. Peering toward the main house, I could see nothing but the thick growth of saplings, ancient live oaks, and a few shaggy evergreens. Even with the limbs bare on the occasional deciduous tree, the distant lights were obscured. I popped open the glove compartment and took out a flashlight. I tested the beam and found that the batteries were strong. I tucked my handbag in the back seat and locked the car as I got out. About 50 feet away, between me and the main house, I could see the skeletal teepee constructions for the pole beams in the now abandoned garden. The air smelled densely of damp moss and eucalyptus. I moved up the steps to the wooden porch that ran along the front of the cabin. The front door had been removed from its hinges and now leaned against the wall to one side of the opening. I flipped the light switch, relieved to note the electrical power was still connected. There was only one fixture overhead, with a 40-watt bulb that bathed the room in drab light. There was little, if any, insulation, and the place was dead cold. While all the window panes were intact, a fine soot had settled in every crevice and crack. Dead insects lined the sills. In one corner of the window frame, a spider had wrapped a fly in a white silken sleeping bag. The air smelled of mold, corroded metal, and spoiled water sitting fallow in the plumbing joints. A section of the wooden floor in the main room had been sawed away by the crime scene unit, the gaping hole covered with a sheet of warped plywood. I picked my way carefully around that. Just above my head, something thumped and scampered through the attic. I imagined squirrels squeezing into roof vents, building nests for their babies. The beam of my flashlight picked up countless artifacts of the 10 months of neglect. Rodent droppings, dead leaves, small pyramids of debris created by the termites. The interior living space was arranged in an L, with a narrow bathroom built into its innermost angle. The plumbing was shared between the bathroom and the kitchenette, with a dining area that wrapped around the corner to the living room. I could see the metal plate in the floor to which the wood-burning stove had been affixed. The walls, painted white, were dotted with daddy long legs, and I found myself keeping an uneasy eye on them as I toured the premises. To one side of the front door was the bell-tone box for the doorbell, about the size of a cigarette pack. Someone had popped the housing away from the wall, and I could see that the interior mechanism was missing. An electrical wire, sheathed in green plastic, had been cut and now drooped sideways like a wilted flower stem with the blossom gone. Lorna's sleeping area had probably been tucked into the short arm of the L. The kitchen cabinets were empty, linoleum-lined shelves still gritty with cornmeal and old cereal dust. Caro syrup or molasses had oozed onto the surface, and I could see circles where the bottoms of the canned goods had formed rings. I checked the bathroom, which was devoid of exterior windows. The toilet was old, the tank tall and narrow. The bowl itself protruded in front like a porcelain Adam's apple. The brown wood seat was cracked and looked as if it would pinch you in places you cherished. The sink was the size of a dishpan supported on two metal legs. I tried the cold water faucet, jumping back with a shriek when a shot of brown water spurted out. The water pipes began to make a low-pitched humming sound, sirens in the underground announcing the crime of trespass. The bathtub rested on ball feet. Dead leaves had collected in a swirling pattern near the drain, while black swans glided across an opaque green plastic shower curtain that hung from an elliptical metal frame. In the main room, despite the lack of furniture, I could surmise how the space had been used. Close to the front door, dents in the pine flooring suggested the placement of a couch and two chairs. I pictured a small wooden dinette set at the other end of the living room, where it turned the corner into the kitchen. To one side of the sink, there was a small cabinet with a phone jack attached just above the baseboard. Lorna probably had a portable phone or a long extension cord, which would have allowed her to keep the phone in the kitchen by day and beside her bed at night. I turned and scanned the premises. Around me, shadows deepened, and the daddy longlegs began to tiptoe down the walls, restless at my intrusion. I eased out of the cabin, keeping a close eye on them. I picked at my dinner, sitting alone in my favorite booth at Rosie's restaurant half a block from my apartment. As usual, Rosie had bullied me into ordering according to her dictates. It's a phenomenon I don't seriously complain about. Beyond McDonald's quarter pounders with cheese, I don't have strong food preferences, and I'm just as happy to have someone else steer me through the menu. Tonight she recommended the caraway seed soup with dumplings, followed by a braised pork dish, yet another Hungarian recipe involving meat stuffs overwhelmed by sour cream and paprika. Rosie's is not so much a restaurant as it is a funky neighborhood bar where exotic dishes are whipped up according to her whims. The place always feels as though it's on the verge of being raided by the food police, so narrowly does it skirt most public health regulations. The scent in the air is a blend of Hungarian spices, beer, and cigarette smoke. The tables in the center of the room are those chrome and formica dinette sets left over from the 1940s. Booths hug the walls. Stiff, high-backed pews sawed out of construction-grade plywood, stained dark brown to disguise all the knotholes and splinters. It was not quite 7, and none of the habitual sports enthusiasts were in evidence. Most nights, especially in the summer months, the place is filled with noisy teams of bowlers and softball players in company uniforms. In winter, they're forced to improvise. Just this week, a group of revelers had invented a game called Toss the Jockstrap, and a hapless example of this support garment was now snagged on the spike of a dusty marlin above the bar. Rosie, who is otherwise quite bossy and humorless, seemed to find this amusing and left it where it was. Apparently, her impending nuptials had lowered her IQ several critical points. She was currently perched up on a bar stool, scanning the local papers while she smoked a cigarette. A small color television set was blaring at one end of the bar, but neither of us was paying much attention to the broadcast. Rosie's beloved William, Henry's older brother, had flown to Michigan with him. Rosie and William were getting married in a month, though the date seemed to drift. The telephone rang from its place on the near end of the bar. Rosie glanced over at it with annoyance, and at first I thought she wouldn't answer it at all. She took her time about it, refolding the paper before she set it aside. She finally answered on the 6th ring, and after she'd exchanged a few brief remarks with the caller, her gaze jumped to mine. She held the receiver in my direction, and then clunked it down on the bar top, probably devastating someone's eardrum. I pushed my dinner plate aside and eased out of the booth, careful that I didn't snag a splinter in the back of my thigh. One day I'm going to rent a belt sander and give all the wooden seats a thorough scouring. I'm tired of worrying about the possibility of impaling myself on spears of cheap plywood. Rosie had moved to the far end of the bar, where she turned down the volume on the TV set. I crossed to the bar and picked up the receiver. Hello?
Hey, Kinsey. Cheney Phillips, how are you?
How'd you know where I was?
I talked to Jonah Robb, and he told me you used to hang out at Rosie's. I tried your home number and your machine picked up, so I figured you might be having dinner.
Good detective work, I said. I didn't even want to ask what had made him think to discuss me with Jonah Robb, who was working the missing persons detail at the Santa Teresa Police Department, where I'd met him 3 years before. I'd had a brief affair with him during one of his wife's periodic episodes of spousal abandonment. Jonah and his wife Camilla had been together since 7th grade. She left him at intervals, but he always took her back again. It was love junior high school style, which became very tedious for those on the periphery. I hadn't known what the game was, and I didn't understand the role I'd been tagged to play. Once I got the message, I'd opted out of the situation. But it left me feeling bad. When you're single, you sometimes make those mistakes. Still, it's disconcerting to think your name is being bandied about. I didn't like the idea that I was the subject of conversation in the local police locker room.
What are you up to? I said to Cheney. Nothing much. I'll be going down to Lower State Street later tonight, looking for a guy with some information I want. I thought you might like to ride along. An old girlfriend of Lorna's tends to hustle her butt in the same neighborhood. If we spot her, I can introduce you. If you're interested, of course.
My heart sank as visions of an early bedtime evaporated. It sounds great. I appreciate the offer. How do you want to work it? Shall I meet you down there?
You can if you like, but it's probably better if I swing by and pick you up on the way. I'll be cruising a big area, and it's hard to know where I'll be.
You know where I live?
Sure, he said and rattled off my address. I'll be there about 11.
That late? I squeaked.
The action doesn't even get rolling till after midnight, he said. Is that a problem?
No, it's fine.
See you then, he said and hung up.
I glanced at my watch and noted with despair that I had about 4 hours to kill. All I really wanted was to hit the sack, but not if I was going to have to get up again. When I'm down, I like to stay down. Naps leave me feeling hungover, without the few carefree moments of an intervening binge. If I was going to drive around with Cheney Phillips until all hours, I thought I'd be better off staying on my feet. I decided I might as well conjure up some work in the interim. I drank 2 cups of coffee and then paid Rosie for my dinner, taking my jacket and handbag as I headed out into the night. The sun had set at 5:45, and the moon probably wouldn't be rising until 2 a.m. At this hour, everybody in the neighborhood was still wide awake. In almost every house I passed, front windows glowed as if the rooms within were aflame. Night moths, like soft birds, batted ineffectually against the porch bulbs. February had silenced all the summer insects, but I could still hear a few hearty crickets in the dry grass, and an occasional nightbird. Otherwise, the quiet was pervasive. It seemed warmer than last night, and I knew from the evening paper that the cloud cover was increasing. The winds were northerly, shaking through the thatch of dried palm fronds above me. I walked the half block to my apartment and let myself in briefly to check for messages. There was nothing on my machine. I went out again before I yielded to the temptation to call Cheney and cancel tonight's big adventure. The squeak in the gate seemed like a melancholy sound, cold metal protesting my departure. I got in my car and turned the key in the ignition, cranking the lever for the heater as soon as the engine roared to life. There was no way the system could deliver hot air so soon, but I needed the illusion of coziness and warmth. I headed out the 101 for half a mile and took the Puerta Street off-ramp. St. Terry's Hospital was only two blocks down. I found a parking space on a side street, locked the car, and walked the remaining half block to the front entrance. Technically, visiting hours didn't start until 8, but I was hoping the nursing director on the cardiac care unit would bend the rules a bit. The glass doors slid open as I approached. I passed the hospital cafe to the left of the lobby, with its couches arranged in numerous conversational groupings. Several ambulatory patients, wearing robes and slippers, had elected to come down and sit with family members and friends. The area was rather like a large, comfortably furnished living room, complete with piped-in music and paintings by local artists. The scent in the lobby was not at all unpleasant, but nonetheless reminded me of hard times. My Aunt Jin had died here on a February night over 10 years ago. I shut the door on the thought and all the memories that came with it. The gift shop was open, and I did a quick detour. I wanted to buy something for Lieutenant Dolan, though I couldn't think quite what. Neither the teddy bears nor the peignoirs seemed appropriate. Finally, I picked up an oversized candy bar and the latest issue of People. Entering a hospital room is always easier with an item in hand. Anything to smooth your intrusion on the intimacies of illness. Ordinarily, I wouldn't dream of conducting business with a man in his pajamas. I paused at the information desk long enough to get his room number and directions to CCU, then hiked down countless corridors toward the bank of elevators in the West Wing. I punched the button for 3 and emerged into a light, airy foyer with a glossy snow-white floor. I turned left into a short hallway. The CCU waiting room was just to the right. I peered through the glass window set into the door. The room was empty and spare. A round table, 3 chairs, 2 love seats, a television set, payphone, and several magazines. I moved over to the door leading into CCU. There was a phone on the wall, and beside it a sign advising me to call in for permission to enter. A nurse or a ward clerk picked up the call, and I told her I wanted to see Lieutenant Dolan.
"Wait a minute, and I'll check."
There was a pause, and then she told me to come on in. The curious thing about illness is that a lot of it looks just like you'd expect. We've seen it all on television, the activity at the nurse's station, the charts and the machinery designed to monitor the ailing. On the cardiac care unit, the floor nurses wore ordinary street clothes, which made the atmosphere seem more relaxed and less clinical. There were 5 or 6 of them, all young and quite friendly. Medical personnel could oversee vital signs from a central vantage point. I stood at the counter and watched 8 different hearts beat, a row of green spiky hiccups on screens lined up on the desk. The ward itself was done in southwestern colors, dusty pinks, mild sky blues, cool pale greens. The doors to each room were made of sliding glass, easily visible from the nurse's station, with draw drapes that could be pulled shut if privacy was required. The feel of the unit was as clean and quiet as a desert. No flowers, no artificial plants, all the laminate surfaces plain and spare. The paintings on the walls were of desert vistas, mountains rising in the distance. I asked for Lieutenant Dolan, and the nurse directed me down the corridor.
Second door on the left, he said.
Thanks. I paused in the doorway of Lieutenant Dolan's room, which was sleek and contemporary.
End of Disc 2. Disc 3.
I paused in the doorway of Lieutenant Dolan's room, which was sleek and contemporary. The bed he rested on was as narrow as a monk's. I was used to seeing him on the job, in a rumpled gray suit, grumpy, harassed, completely businesslike. Here he seemed smaller. He was wearing an unstructured pastel cotton gown with short sleeves and a tie back. He sported a day's growth of beard, which showed prickly gray across his cheeks. I could see the tired, ropey flesh of his neck, and his once muscular arms were looking stringy and thin. A floor-to-ceiling column near the head of his bed housed the paraphernalia necessary to monitor his status. Cables pasted to his chest looped up to a plug in the column, where a screen played out his vital signs like a ticker tape. He was reading the paper, half-glasses low on his nose. He was attached to an IV. When he caught sight of me, he set the paper aside and took his glasses off. He gave the edge of the sheet a tug, pulling it across his bare feet. He motioned me in.
Well, look who it is. What brings you down here?
He ran a hand through his hair, which was sparse at best, and now looked as if it had been slicked back with sweat. He pushed himself up against the angled bed. His plastic hospital bracelet made his wrist seem vulnerable, but he didn't seem ill. It was as if I'd caught him on a Sunday morning, lounging around in his pajamas before church.
Cheney told me you were laid up, so I thought I'd pop by. I hope I didn't interrupt your paper. I've read it 3 times. I'm so desperate I'm down to the personals. Somebody named Errol wants Louise to call him, in case you know either one.
I smiled, wishing he looked stronger, knowing I'd look even worse if I were in his place. I held out the magazine.
For you, I said. I figure nothing in your condition precludes an overdose of gossip. If you're really bored, you can always do the crossword puzzle in the back. How are you feeling? You look good.
I'm not bad. I've been better. The doctor's talking about moving me off the unit tomorrow, which seems like a good sign.
He scratched at the stubble on his chin.
I'm taking advantage by refusing to shave. What do you think?
Very devil may care, I said. You can go straight from here to life on the bum.
Pull a chair over. Have a seat. Just move that.
The chair in the near corner had the rest of the paper and several magazines piled up on the seat. I set the whole batch aside and dragged the chair over toward the bed, aware that both Dolan and I were using chit-chat and busy work to cover a basic uneasiness.
What are they telling you about going back to work?
They won't say at this point, but I imagine it'll be a while yet. 2, 3 months. I scared him pretty bad from what everybody says. Hell, Tom Flowers ended up doing mouth-to-mouth, which he'll never live down. Must have been a sight for sore eyes.
You're still with us, at any rate.
That I am. Anyway, how are you? Cheney told me about Janice Kepler. How's it going so far?
I shrugged. All right, I guess. I've been on it less than a day. I'm supposed to meet Cheney later. He's going to cruise lower state looking for a snitch, and offered to point out a chum of Lorna's while he's about it.
Probably Danielle, Dolan said. We talked to her at the time, but she wasn't much help. You know, these little gals, the life they live is so damn dangerous. Night after night, connecting up with strangers. Get in a car and you have to be aware it might be the last ride you ever take. And they see us as the enemy. I don't know why they do it. They're not stupid.
They're desperate.
I guess that's what it is. This town is nothing compared to L.A., but it's still the pits. You take someone like Lorna, and it makes no sense whatsoever.
You have a theory about who killed her?
I wish I did. She kept her distance. She didn't buddy up to people. Her lifestyle was too unconventional for most.
Oh, I'll say. Has anybody told you about the video?
Cheney mentioned it. I gather you've seen it. I probably ought to take a look myself, see if I recognize any of the players.
You better wait till you're home. It'll get your heart rate right up there. Janice Kepler gave me a copy. She's feeling very paranoid and made me swear I'd guard the damn thing with my very life. I haven't checked the dirty bookstores, but it wouldn't surprise me to see a half dozen copies in stock. From the packaging, it looks like it was manufactured up in the Bay Area someplace.
You going up there?
I'd like to. Seems like it's worth a try if I can talk Janice into it.
Cheney says you want to take a look at the crime scene photographs.
If you don't object. I saw the cabin this afternoon, but it's been empty for months. I'd like to see what it looked like when the body was found. Lieutenant Dolan's brow furrowed with distaste.
You're welcome to take a look, but you better brace yourself. That's the worst decomp case I ever saw. We had to do toxicology from bone marrow and whatever little bit of liver tissue we could salvage.
There's no doubt it was her?
Absolutely none, he said.
He lifted his eyes to the monitor, and I followed his gaze. His heartbeat had picked up, and the green line was looking like a row of ragged grass.
Amazes me how the memory of something like that can cause a physiological reaction after all these months.
Did you ever see her in real life?
No, and it's probably just as well. I felt bad enough as it was. Dust to dust doesn't quite cover it. Anyway, I'll call records and get a set for you. When do you want to go over there?
Right now, if possible. Cheney doesn't pick me up for another 3 hours yet. I was up late last night and I'm dead on my feet. My only hope is to keep moving.
Photographs will wake you up.
Most of the departments at the police station closed down at 6. The crime lab was closed and the detectives gone for the day. In the bowels of the building, the 911 dispatchers would still be sitting at their consoles, fielding emergency calls. The main counter, where parking tickets are paid, was as blank as the ribs on a roll-top desk, a sign indicating that the window would open again at 8 a.m. The door to records was locked, but I could tell there were a couple of people working, probably data processing technicians entering the day's warrants into the system. The small front counter wasn't currently manned, but I managed to lean over, peering into the records department around the corner to the right. A uniformed officer spotted me and broke away from a conversation with a civilian clerk. He moved in my direction.
Can I help you?
I just talked to Lieutenant Dolan over at St. Terry's. He and Detective Phillips are letting me look at some files. There should be a set of photographs he said I could take.
The name was Kepler, right? Lieutenant just called. I have him right back here. You want to come on through?
Thanks. The officer depressed a button, releasing the door lock. I went through into a back hallway and turned right. The officer reappeared in the doorway to records and identification.
We got a desk back here if you want to take a seat.
I read through the file with care, making notes as I went. Janice Kepler had given me much of the same material, but there were many interdepartmental memos and notes that hadn't been part of her packet. I found the witness interviews the police had conducted with Hector Moreno, J.D. Burke, and Serena Bonney, whose home address and phone number I jotted down. There were additional interviews with Lorna's family, her former boss Roger Bonney, and the very Danielle Rivers I was hoping to meet on Lower State Street tonight. Again, I made a note of home addresses and telephone numbers. This was information I could develop on my own, but why pass it up? Lieutenant Dolan had left word that I could photocopy anything I needed. I took copies of countless pages. I'd probably interview many of the same people, and it would be instructive to compare their current opinions and observations with those made at the time. Finally, I turned my attention to the crime scene photographs. In some ways, it's hard to know which is more sordid, the pornography of sex or the pornography of homicide. Both speak of violence, the broken and debased, the humiliations to which we subject one another in the heat of passion. Some forms of sex are as cold-blooded as murder, some kinds of murder as titillating to the perpetrator as a sexual encounter. Decomposition had erased most of the definition from Lorna Kepler's flesh. The very enzymes embedded in her cells had caused her to disintegrate. The body had been invaded, nature's little cleaning crew busily at work, maggots as light as a snowfall and as white as thread. It took me many minutes before I could look at the photographs without revulsion. Finally, I was able to detach myself. This was simply the reality of death.
I was interested in the sight of the cabin in its furnished state. I had seen it empty, sooty and forsaken, full of spiders and mildew, the fusty smell of neglect. Here in full color, and again in black and white, I could see fabric, crowded countertops in use, sofa pillows in disarray, a vase full of sagging flowers and an inch of darkened water. Rag rugs, the spindle-lathed wooden chair legs. I could see a pile of mail on the sofa cushion where she'd left it. There was something distasteful about the unexpected glimpses of her living space. Like a house guest arriving early who sees the place before the hostess has had the chance to tidy up. Aside from a few photographs meant to orient the viewer, Lorna's body was the prime subject of most 8x10 glossies. She lay on her stomach. Her posture was that of someone sleeping, her limbs arranged in the classic chalk outline that marks the position of the corpse in any TV show. No blood, no emesis. It was hard to imagine what she was doing when she went down, answering the front door, running for the telephone. She wore a bra and underpants, her jogging clothes tossed in a pile close by. Her long dark hair still carried its sheen, a tumble of glossy strands. In the light of the flashbulb, small white maggots glowed like a spray of seed pearls. I slipped the pictures back in the manila envelope and tucked them in my handbag. Chapter 7. I was leaning against my VW, parked at the curb in front of my place, when Cheney came around the corner in a VW that looked even older than mine. It was beige, very dinged up, an uncanny replica of the 1968 sedan I had run off the road nearly 2 years before. Cheney chugged to a stop, and I tried opening the car door on the passenger side. No deal. I finally had to put a foot up against the side of the car to get sufficient leverage to wrench the door open. The squawk it made sounded like a large, unruly beast breaking wind. I slid onto the seat and pulled futilely at the door, trying to close it. Cheney reached across me and wrenched it shut again. He threw the gears into first and took off with his engine rumbling. "Nice car. I used to have one just like this," I said. I yanked at the seat belt, making a vain attempt to buckle it across my lap. The whole device was frozen, and I finally just had to pray he'd drive without crashing and burning. I do so hate to end an evening being flung through the windshield. At my feet I could feel a breeze blowing through a hole where the floor had rusted out. If it were daytime, I knew I'd see the road whipping past, like that small glimpse of track you see when you flush the toilet on a train. I tried to keep my feet up to avoid putting weight on the spot, lest I plunge through. If the car stalled, I could push us along with one foot without leaving my seat. I started to roll down the window and discovered that the crank was gone. I opened the wing window on my side, and chilly air slanted in. So far, the wing window was the only thing on my side that functioned. Cheney was saying, "I have a little sports car, too, but I figure there's no point in taking anything like that into the neighborhood we'll be in. Did you talk to Dolan yet?"
I went over to St. Terry's to see him this evening. He was a doll, I must say. I went straight from the hospital to the station to look at files. He even provided me copies of the crime scene photographs.
How'd he seem?
He was okay, I guess. Not as grouchy as usual. Why? What's your impression?
He was depressed when I talked to him, but he might have brought himself up for you.
He has to be scared.
I sure would be, Cheney said.
Tonight he was wearing a pair of slick Italian shoes, dark pants, a coffee-brown dress shirt, and a soft, cream suede windbreaker. I have to say he didn't look like any undercover cop I ever saw. He glanced over at me and caught the fact that I was conducting a visual survey.
What?
Where are you from? I asked.
Perdido, he said,
naming a little town 30 miles south of us.
What about you?
I'm local, I said. Your name seems familiar.
You've known me for years.
Yes, but do I know you from somewhere else? Do you have family in the area? He made a noncommittal mouth sound that generally indicated yes. I looked at him closely. Being a liar myself, I can recognize other people's evasive maneuvers. What's your family do?
Banks.
What about banks? They make deposits? They do holdups?
They own some.
I stared at him, comprehension dawning like a big cartoon sun. Your father is X Phillips? As in Bank of X Phillips? He nodded mutely. What is it, Xavier?
Actually, it's just X.
What's your other car, a Jag?
Hey, just because he has big bucks doesn't mean I do. I have a Mazda. It's not fancy. Well, a little bit fancy, but it's paid for.
I said, don't get defensive. How'd you end up a cop? Cheney smiled.
When I was a kid, I watched a lot of TV. I was raised in an atmosphere of benign neglect. My mother sold high-end real estate while my father ran his banks. Cop shows made a big impression. More than financial matters, at any rate.
Is your dad okay with that?
He doesn't have any choice. He knows I'm not going to follow in his footsteps. Besides, I'm dyslexic. To me, the printed page looks like gibberish. What about your parents? Are they still alive?
Please note, I'm aware that you're changing the subject, but I'm electing to answer the question you asked. They both died a long time ago. As it turns out, I do have family up in Lompoc, but I haven't decided what to do about them yet.
What's to decide? I didn't know we had a choice about these things.
Long story. They've ignored my existence now for 29 years, and suddenly they want to make nice. It doesn't sit well with me. That kind of family I can do without. Cheney smiled.
Look at it this way. I feel the same way about mine, and I've been in touch with them since birth.
I laughed. Are we cynical or what?
The or what part sounds right.
I turned my attention to the area we'd begun to cruise. It was not far from my place. Down along Cabana Boulevard, a left turn across the tracks. The condominiums and small houses began to give way to commercial properties. Warehouses, light industry, a wholesale seafood company, a moving and storage facility. Many buildings were long, low, and windowless. Tucked in along a side street was one of two adult bookstores. The other was located on the lower end of State Street, several blocks away. Here, small, barren trees were spaced at long intervals. The streetlight seemed pale respite against the wide stretches of the dark. Looking off toward the mountains, I could see the smoky glow of the town washed up against the sky. The houses along the hillside were linked together in a fairyland of artificial lights. We began to pass small groups of people, five or six leaning against cars, clusters of the young whose sex was difficult to distinguish. Their eyes followed us without fail. Conversations halted momentarily in the hopes that we would offer business of one sort or another. Sex or drugs, it probably didn't matter as long as money changed hands. Through the window I could smell the dope as joints were passed from hand to hand. The dull booming of a bass note signaled the proximity of the establishment we were looking for. Neptune's Palace was a combination bar and pool hall, with an open courtyard along one side, surrounded by a wide asphalt parking lot. Patrons had spilled out into both the courtyard and the parking lot. The yellow glow of mercury vapor lights streamed across the gleaming tops of parked cars. Blasts of music spilled from the bar. Near the front of the place, girls were lounging against a low wall, their eyes following as a succession of vehicles cruised by in search of the night's adventure. The double doors stood open like the entrance to a cave, the rectangle of tawny light softened by a fog of cigarette smoke. We circled the block twice, Cheney peering out for sight of Danielle. No sign of her? I asked.
She'll be here someplace. For her, this is like the unemployment office.
We found a parking place around the corner where the night air was quieter. We got out and locked the car, moving along the sidewalk past numerous same-sex couples who seemed to view us with amusement. Heterosexuals are so out of it. Cheney and I pushed our way into the bar, merging with the shoals of inebriated patrons. Music blasted from the dance floor. The damp heat from all the bodies inside was nearly tropical in its nature. The very air smelled briny from the cheap beer on tap. The nautical theme was everywhere apparent. Big fishing nets were draped from the beams across the ceiling,
where reflecting bulbs played like sunlight on surface water. Up there, a light show simulated twilight on the ocean, day fading into sunset, followed by the jet black of night. Sometimes the constellations were projected overhead, and sometimes ferocious cracks of lightning formed the apparition of a storm at sea. The walls were painted in a multitude of blues, shades graduating downward from the calm blue of a summer swell to the midnight hues of the deep. Sawdust on the concrete flooring created the illusion of the ocean's sandy bottom. The dance floor itself was defined by what looked like the prow of a sunken ship. So perfect was the fantasy of life beneath the sea that I found myself feeling grateful for every breath I took. The tables were tucked into alcoves made to look like coral reefs. The lighting was muted, much of it emanating from massive saltwater aquariums in which large, pouty-mouthed groupers undulated endlessly in search of prey. Reproduction antique navigational charts were embedded in polyurethane on every tabletop, and the world they portrayed was one of vast, unpopulated oceans with treacherous creatures lurking at the outer edges. Not so different from the patrons themselves. In the occasional brief lull between cuts, I picked up the faint effects being played through the sound system. Ship's bells, the creak of wood, sails flapping, the shriek of seagulls, the tinny warning of the buoys. Most eerie was the nearly undiscernible wails of drowning seamen, as if all of us were caught up in some maritime purgatory, in which alcohol, cigarettes, laughter, and pounding music served to ward off those faint cries creeping into the silence. All the waitresses were dressed in skin-tight, spangled bodysuits, as shimmering as fish scales. I had to guess most had been hired on the basis of their androgyny. Cropped hair, slim hips, and no breasts to speak of. Even the boys were wearing makeup. Cheney stayed close behind me, his hand placed comfortably in the middle of my back. Once he leaned to say something, but the noise in the place obliterated his voice. He disappeared at one point and came back with a bottle of beer in each hand. We found an expanse of unpopulated wall with a largely unobstructed view of the place. We leaned there, people watching. The volume of the music would necessitate a hearing test later. I could picture all the cilia in my ear canal going flat. I'd once fired a gun from the depths of a garbage bin, and ever since had been plagued by an intermittent hissing deep inside my head. These kids were going to need ear trumpets by the age of 25. Cheney touched my arm and then pointed across the room. His mouth formed the word Danielle, and I followed his gaze. She was standing near the door, apparently alone, though I had to guess she wouldn't be for long. She was probably in her late teens, lying regularly about her age, else how would she get in here? She had dark hair long enough to sit on, and long legs that seemed to go on forever. Even at that distance, I could see slim hips, a flat belly, and the breasts of early adolescence, a body type much admired by the postmenopausal male. She was wearing lime green satin hot pants and a halter top with a lime green bomber jacket over it. We made our way across the room. At a certain point in our progress, she spotted Cheney's approach. He pointed toward the courtyard. She pivoted and went out in advance of us. Outside, the temperature dropped dramatically, and the sudden absence of cigarette smoke made the air smell like freshly cut hay. The chill felt like liquid pouring over my skin. Danielle had turned to face us, hands in her jacket pockets. Up close, I could see the skillful use of cosmetics in the battle she must have fought with her own youthful looks. She could have passed for 12. Her eyes were the luminous green of certain tropical fish, and her look was insolent. "We have a car parked around the corner," Cheney said without preamble.
"So?"
"So we could have a little talk, just the three of us."
"About what?"
"Life in general. Lorna Kepler in particular."
Danielle's eyes were fixed on mine.
"Who's she?"
"This is Kinsey. Lorna's mother hired her."
"This is not a bust," she said warily.
"Oh, come on, Danielle. It's not a bust. She's a private investigator looking into Lorna's death."
"Because I'm telling you, Cheney, you set me up for something, you could get me in real trouble."
"It's not a setup, it's a meeting.
She'll pay your regular rates.
I gave Cheney a look. I'd have to pay the little twerp?
Danielle's gaze raked the parking lot and then strayed in my direction.
I don't do women, she said sullenly.
I leaned forward and said, Hey, me neither.
In case anybody gives a shit.
Cheney ignored me and addressed himself to her.
What are you afraid of?
What am I afraid of? She said, finger pointing to her own chest. Her nails were bitten to the quick. I'm afraid of Lester, for one thing. I'm afraid of losing my teeth. I'm afraid Mr. Dickhead's going to flatten my nose again. The guy's a bastard, a real prick.
You should have pressed charges. I told you that the last time, Cheney said.
Oh, right. I should have gone ahead and checked into the morgue, saved myself that messy middle step, she snapped.
Come on, help us out, Cheney coaxed.
She thought about it, looking off into the dark. Finally, grudgingly, she said, I'll talk to her, not to you.
That's all I'm asking.
I'm not doing it because you're asking. I'm doing it for Lorna, and just this once. I mean it. I don't want you to set me up like this again.
Cheney grinned seductively.
You're too perfect.
Danielle made a face, mimicking his manner, which she wasn't buying for a minute. She headed off toward the street, talking back across her shoulder.
Let's get it over with before Lester shows up.
Cheney walked us to the car, where we went through the requisite door-wrenching exercise. The ensuing squawk was so loud, a couple halfway down the block stopped necking long enough to see what kind of creature we were torturing. I took the passenger seat and let Danielle take the driver's side, in case she needed to make a hasty getaway. Whoever Lester was, I was getting nervous myself.
Cheney leaned toward the wing window.
Back in a bit.
You see Lester, don't you tell him where I'm at, she warned.
Trust me, Cheney said.
Trust him? What a joke, she said to no one in particular.
We watched him through the front windshield as he disappeared into the dark. I sat there, hoping her Monday night rates were low. I couldn't remember how much cash I had on me, and I didn't think she'd take my visa, which was maxed out anyway.
You can smoke if you want, I said, thinking to ingratiate myself.
I don't smoke, she said, offended. Smoking wrecks your health. You know how much we pay in this country for smoking-related illnesses? $15 billion a year. My father died of emphysema. It was like walking suffocation every day of his life. Eyes bugging out. He's breathing. He's like this.
She paused to demonstrate, hand on her chest. The sounds she made were a combination of rasping and choking.
And he can't get any air. It's a horrible way to die, dragging around this old oxygen tank. You better quit while you're ahead.
I don't smoke. I thought you might. I was being polite.
Don't be polite on my account, she said. I hate smoking. It's very bad for you. Plus, it stinks.
Danielle looked around then, regarding the interior of the VW with distaste.
What a pigsty. You could get a disease sitting in this thing.
At least you know he's not on the take, I said.
Cops in this town don't take money, she said. They have too much fun sticking people in the can. He's got a much nicer car, but he's too paranoid to bring it down here.
So, enough with the chit-chat, get-to-know-you bullshit. What do you want to know about Lorna?
As much as you can tell me. How long did you know her?
Danielle's mouth pulled down in a facial shrug. Couple of years. We met working for this escort service. She was a good person. She was like a mother to me. She was my, what do you call him, mentor. Only now I see I should have listened to her more.
How so?
Lorna killed me. She was great. She really blew me away. I was like totally in awe. She knew what she wanted, and she went after it. And if you didn't like where she was coming from, then it was too bad for you.
What did she want?
$1 million for starters. She wanted to retire by the time she was 30. She could have done it, too, if she'd lived long enough.
How'd she propose to do it?
How do you think?
That's a lot of time on your back, I said.
Not at the rates she charged. After she left the escort service, she was making $200,000 a year. $200,000! I couldn't believe it. She was smart. She invested. She didn't blow money the way I would have if I'd been in her shoes. I got no head for finance. What's in my pocket, I spend, and when it's gone, I start over. At least I used to be that way until she straightened me out.
What was she going to do when she retired?
Travel, goof off, maybe marry some guy who'd take care of her for life. Thing is, and here's what she kept hammering at me about, you got money, you're independent, you can do anything you want. Some guy mistreats you, you get the fuck out. You can walk. Know what I'm saying?
That's my philosophy, I said.
Yeah, mine too, now. After she died, I opened a little savings account, and I salted away. It's not much, but it's enough, and I'm going to let it sit. That's what Lorna always said. You put it in the bank, and you let it collect interest. She put a lot of her money in blue-chip stocks, municipal bonds, shit like that. But she did it all herself. She wasn't into this business about financial managers and people like that, because for one thing, she said it's the perfect excuse for some asshole to come along and rip you off. You know stockbrokers? She called them portfolio pimps.
She laughed at the phrase, apparently amused at the idea of procurers on Wall Street.
What about you? You got savings?
As a matter of fact, I do.
Where is it? What did you do with it?
I put it in CDs, I said, feeling faintly sensitive on the subject. It seemed strange defending my financial strategy to some girl who worked the streets.
That's good. Lorna did some of that, too. She liked tax-free munis, and she had some of her money in Ginnie Mae's, whatever they are. Listen to us. This is what I like, talking about all this long-term stuff. You have money, that's power, and no guy can come along and punch your lights out, right?
You mentioned her making $200,000. She pay taxes on the money?
Of course. Never fuck with the feds was her first rule of thumb. That's the first thing she taught me. Anything you make, you declare. Know how they got Al Capone and those guys? Undeclared income. You cheat the feds, you end up in the can, like big time, and that's no lie.
What about...
Just a minute, she cut in. Let me ask you something else. How much do you earn?
I stared at her. How much do I earn?
Yeah, like last year. What was your annual income? What did you pay taxes on?
That's getting pretty personal, isn't it?
You don't have to act like that. This is strictly between us. You say, and then I will. We'll trade tit for tat, as it were.
$25,000. Now it was her turn to stare.
That's all? I earned twice that. No fooling. $52,500 and change.
You got your nose broken, too, I pointed out.
Yeah, well, you had your nose broken. I can tell by looking. I'm not criticizing, no offense, she said. You're not a bad-looking chick, but for $25,000, you get punched in the chops same as me, am I right?
I wouldn't look at it quite like that.
Don't bullshit yourself. I learned that from Lorna, too. Take my word for it. Your job is dangerous the same as mine, with only half the pay. You ought to switch, in my opinion. Not that I'm promoting my line of work. I'm just telling you what I think.
I appreciate your concern. If I decide to change careers, I'll come to you for job counseling. She smiled, amused at the sarcasm, or what she assumed was sarcasm.
I'll tell you something else she taught me. Keep your big mouth shut. You do a guy, you don't talk about it afterward, especially in the crowd she's running in. She slipped up once and swore she'd never do it again. Some of those guys? Whew! You're better off forgetting you ever knew them.
Do you travel in those circles? The real high-class stuff?
Well, not all the time. Not now. When she was alive, I did now and then. Like once in a while, she'd dress me up fancy and take me with her on a big one. Me and this other girl named Rita.
What a hoot.
Some guys like 'em young. You shave your pubes and act like you're about 10 years old. Like this one night, I made over $1,500.
Don't ask me doing what.
That's something else you don't talk about. Lester would have killed me if he found out.
What happened to all her money when she died? I asked.
Beats the hell out of me. You'd have to ask her folks about that. I bet she didn't have a will. I mean, what did she need a will for? She was young. Well, 25, which is not that old. I bet she thought she had years, and it turned out she had nothing.
How old are you?
23.
You are not.
I am too.
Danielle, you're not.
She smiled slightly. Okay, I'm 19, but I'm mature for my age.
I said, 17 is probably closer, but we'll let that pass.
You better ask more about Lorna. You're wasting your money when you ask about me.
What was Lorna doing out at the water treatment plant?
That doesn't sound like it was worth even the part-time pay. She had to do something. She couldn't tell her parents how she was earning her bread. They were real conservative. At least her dad was.
I met her mom at the funeral, and she seemed nice enough. Her old man was a butt, all the time on her case, checking up on her. Lorna was a wild one, and she didn't like to be controlled.
I talked to her father earlier today, and he said Lorna didn't have many friends.
Danielle dismissed that with a toss of her head. What does he know? Just because he never met any. Lorna liked night people. Everybody she knew came out of hiding when the sun went down, like spiders and all those, what do you call them, nocturnal creatures, owls and bats. You want to meet her friends, you better get used to staying out all night. What else? This is fun. I didn't realize I was so smart.
What about the porno film? Why'd she do that?
Oh, same old, same old. You know how it is. Some guy came down from San Francisco. She met him one night in the Edgewater and got to talking about that stuff. He thought she'd be dynamite, and I guess she was. At first she didn't want to do it, but then she figured, hey, why not? She didn't get paid much, but she said she had a ball. What did you hear about that?
I didn't hear about it. I saw it.
You did not? You saw that?
Sure, I have a copy.
Well, that's weird. That video was never released.
Now it was my turn to express skepticism. Really? It never went into distribution? I don't believe it. We sounded like a couple of talking birds.
That's what she said. She was pissed off about it, too. She thought it could be her big break, but there was nothing she could do.
The cassette I saw was edited, packaged, the whole bit. They must have had a lot of money tied up in it. What's the story?
I just know what she said. Maybe the venture was undercapitalized, whatever the term is. How'd you get a copy?
Someone sent it to her mother.
Danielle barked out a laugh. You're kidding. That's gross. What kind of jerk would do a thing like that?
I don't know yet. I'm hoping to find out. What else can you tell me?
No, you ask and I'll answer. I can't think of anything off the top of my head.
Who's Lester?
Lester had nothing to do with Lorna.
But who is he? She gave me a look.
What's it to you?
You're afraid of him, and I want to know why.
Get off it. You're wasting your money.
Maybe I can afford it.
Oh, right. On what you make? That's bullshit.
Actually, I don't even know what you're charging.
Trick rates, $50.
An hour? I yelped.
Not an hour. What's the matter with you? $50 a trick. Nothing about sex takes an hour, she said contemptuously. Anybody says it's an hour is ripping you off.
I take it Lester's your pimp.
Listen to her. Pimp? Who taught you to talk that way? Lester Dudley, Mr. Dickhead to you, is my personal manager. He's like my professional representative.
Did he represent Lorna?
Of course not. I already told you. She was smart. She declined his services.
You think he'd have any information about her?
Not a chance. Don't even bother. The guy's a real piece of shit.
I thought for a moment, but I'd covered the questions that came readily to mind. Well, this should do for now. If you think of anything else, will you get in touch?
Sure, she said. As long as you got the money, I got the mouth. So to speak.
I picked up my handbag and took out my wallet. I gave her a business card, jotting my home address and telephone number on the back. Ordinarily, I don't like to give out that information, but I wanted to make it as easy for her as possible. I reviewed my cash supply. I thought maybe she'd be magnanimous and waive her fees, but she held her hand out, watching carefully as I counted bills into her palm. I had to make up the last dollar with the loose change in the bottom of my bag. Of course, I was short.
Don't worry about it. You can owe me the dime.
I'll give you an IOU, I said. She waved the offer aside.
I trust you. She tucked the money in her jacket pocket. Men are funny, you know. Big male fantasy about hookers. I see this in all these books written by men. Some guy meets a hooker, and she's gorgeous. Big knockers, refined, and she's got the hots for him. Him and her end up bonking, and when he's done, she won't take his money. He's so wonderful, she doesn't want to charge him money like she does everyone else. Now that's bullshit for sure. I never knew a hooker who'd do a guy for free. Anyway, hooker sex is for shit. If he thinks that's a gift, then the joke's on him.
Chapter 8. It was close to 1:30 in the morning when I parked my VW in the little parking lot outside the emergency entrance to St. Terry's Hospital. After my conversation with Danielle, Cheney had dropped me back at my place.
I moved in through the squeaking gate and around to the back. I heard Cheney give his horn a toot, and then he took off. The night sky was still clear, bright with stars, but I could see patchy clouds collecting at the western edge as predicted. An airplane moved across my field of vision, a distant dot of red winking among the pinpricks of white, the sound trailing behind it like a banner advertising flight. The final quarter of the moon had narrowed to the curved silver of a shepherd's crook, a cloud like a wisp of cotton caught in its crescent. I could have sworn I still heard the booming music that had shaken Neptune's palace. In reality, the club was less than a mile from my apartment, and I suppose it was possible the sound might have carried. It was more likely a stereo or a car radio in much closer range. Against the drumming of the high tide at the ocean half a block away, the faint thump of bass was a muted counterpoint, brooding, silky, and indistinct. I paused, keys in hand, and leaned my head briefly against the door to my place. I was tired, but curiously disinterested in sleep. I've always been a day person, thoroughly addicted to early rising and morning sunshine in a 9-to-5 world. I might work late on occasion, but for the most part I'm home by early evening and sound asleep by 11. Tonight, yet again, I was nudged by restlessness. Some long-suppressed aspect of my personality was being activated, and I could feel myself respond. I wanted to talk to Serena Bonney, the nurse who discovered Lorna's body. Somewhere in the accumulating verbal portrait of Lorna Kepler was the key to her death. I went back through the gate and closed it quietly behind me. The emergency room had an air of abandonment. The sliding glass doors opened with a hush, and I moved into the quiet of the blue and gray space. There were lights on in the reception area, but the patient registration windows had been closed for hours. To the left, behind a small partition with its wall-mounted pay telephones, the waiting room was empty, the TV a square of blank gray. I peered to the right, toward the examining rooms. Most were dark, with the surrounding curtains pulled back and secured on overhead tracks. I could smell freshly perked coffee wafting from a little kitchenette at the rear of the facility. A young black woman in a white lab coat came out of a doorway marked Linens. She was small and pretty. She paused when she spotted me, flashing a smile. "Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know anyone was here. Can I help you?" "I'm looking for Serena Bonney. Is she working this shift?" The woman glanced at her watch. "She should be back shortly. She's on her break. You want to have a seat? The TV's on the blank, but there's lots of reading material." "Thanks." For the next 15 minutes, I read outdated issues of Family Circle magazine. Articles about children, health and fitness, nutrition, home decorating, and inexpensive home-building projects meant for Dad in his spare time. A wooden bench, a treehouse, a rustic shelf to support Mom's picturesque garden of container herbs. To me, it was like reading about life on an alien planet. All the ads showed such perfect women. Most were 30 years old, white, and had flawless complexions.